My name is Ski, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi,
I like to keep my last name anonymous because it's easier to pronounce. Actually, my last name is Andrashovsky. And when I use it, I get repercussions like that, like down at the laundry. The girl said, why don't you get an American name? I said, what's your name? She says, Garcia. Had a major in the Marine Corps do that. He said, Ski, why don't you change your name? I said, I'm thinking about it, but I'm going to wait to see who wins the next war. Somebody has to have a hat, see? And you know, what is it, drinking like a gentleman? I never drank like a gentleman. Social drinker. You know, they keep trying to make social drinkers out of us. About every 5 years, they come up with a cure for alcoholism. And every time they do, they kill about 5,000 of us. And we're about ready for another cure, you know. We're due now. What if they ever came up with a cure that worked? They gave you a pill, you become a social drinker. Big deal. That entitles you to 2 drinks. And you don't even get to drink them. You drink 1.5. And you have to leave a half on the bar and walk out saying something stupid like, I'm beginning to feel it. If they figured out a way where we could drink a 1.5 sociably, it would make a little more sense, you know? You know, I was a bootlegger's son. I was a bartender at 15. And I went into the Marine Corps at 18. And I was a drunken Marine for about 18.5 years. 18.5 years I drank. I never went out the gates for any other reason. I used to see people go out the gates with a camera around their neck. Yeah. And I used to think they were oddballs, you know. He's going to the USO or someplace, you know, with a camera. I was in the Marine Corps before World War II started. And when the war started, I went right to Guadalcanal. I fell right in with all the boozers. We needed each other even then. We shared our experience, strength, and booze. And it's hard to get good whiskey in the South Pacific, you know, during the war. So we had to resort to other things. We'd all go out and steal all the peaches and cherries and plums, anything that would ferment. We'd bring it all back and put it in an expeditionary can with a little yeast and sugar. And you let it set for 7 days, and when the little flies appeared, it was done, and we drank it. We never drank it before its time. And they call this stuff jungle juice. And I was a member of the Jungle Juice Club. And you could tell who the members of the club were. If you went down to the chow line, it was the guys with the black canteen cups. In fact, if you drank this stuff, you got a purple heart. You know, not the metal, a real purple heart. And I went through World War II drinking this stuff. The only trouble is that when you really needed it, you couldn't get it. Because they start curling your hair with machine gun fire, it's kind of hard to stop and mix up a batch of jungle juice. And that's when I needed it. And if I couldn't get anything to drink when I was scared, I prayed in that order. And I made a lot of promises. Get me out of this alive and I'll do anything. Get me out of this alive. I remember the ultimate promise I made in World War II. was get me out of this alive and I'll become a priest. I got hit a couple of times on Peleliu when I was aboard a hospital ship, paralyzed. And a chaplain cornered me, and it's pretty easy to get religious under these kind of conditions. And he gave me a Bible to read. And I read that Bible, and I read that Bible, and I read that Bible day and night. I just got to the point where I started to bless people. When I got well, and they sent me back to the States, and I got liberty. And I saw a blonde walk into a dim-lit bar, and I forgot all about my promises. You know, that's the way that went. I got back to the States and drank just as much as ever. And I got discharged. I went out and I stayed drunk for 6 months. I ran a cheat spot. And I knew I was going to die. I was 22 years old. I was definitely an alcoholic. I was drinking round the clock. I was having blackouts. I'd be drinking in Cleveland and wind up in Pittsburgh somehow. After I was on the program a while, I looked back at this civilian period, and I remember the day I went down to the priest's house looking for help. I was 22 years old. Some woman came to the door, and she said, "Come back when you're sober." The next day, the thought of it caused me to go out and get drunk again, you know? I knew it was Cleveland's fault and the business we were in, and I had too many friends in Cleveland. I couldn't possibly stay sober in Cleveland. So I took a geographical. I went down to recruiting office and I re-enlisted and I asked for China. I figured I didn't have any friends in China. I wouldn't drink so much. And then again, I thought in the event I did drink so much, at least the people I hurt would be strangers. And the Marine Corps sent me to Quantico, Virginia, and I did a lot of drunks and moving around. I went to Brooklyn, and then I remember I shot my way back from Japan. The way I got to be in San Diego. I shot my way back from Japan. And when the matches were over, I stayed here in Pendleton. And I was on Liberty in Oceanside, driving down Hill Street, going from the sandbox to the King's Room. And the way I used to tell that story is I was heading down Hill Street, and this idiot in front of me slammed on the brakes in front of me to stop for a yellow light, and I was going to try to make the light, and I rammed right into the back end of him. But the way that really happened, I was driving down Hill Street, and all of a sudden my car stopped, and a cop opened the door, and I fell out. And they put me in jail. And my captain came out and he got me out of jail, out of the Oceanside jail there. He got me out of jail. He said, "I'll get you out under one condition. You don't take another drink while you're in my command." And I promised I wouldn't take another drink. And I was sincere when I made the promise. It took about 2 days, and I was back in the King's Room shooting pool for 7-ups. And I remember I was pretty good on the pool table because I'd look and there'd be about 6 or 7 or a dozen Pepsis or 7-ups sitting on the bar waiting for me to drink them. And I was thinking I'm going to drown if I keep drinking this stuff. And I ordered a beer and I was back off and running again. It was a few days later I smashed my car up again. I was living in Wire Mountain, and I ran into the Wire Mountain. I hit a cliff. And I had to sneak my car off the base back to the place where they just fixed it. And a brand new Studebaker, you know, I told them, "Just hammer it out. I don't have insurance." I said, "Just straighten out the headlights." And I had to sneak past the captain's office all the time. Because he's going to see my eyeballs and he knows I'm back drinking again. And I had it. And I saw a bulletin board that said, "Drill instructors. They wanted volunteers." Nobody wanted it. I volunteered for drill instructor school because I had to get out of that captain's command. That's how I come to be in San Diego today, you know. And I went through drill instructor school. And By now, I had a wife and 5 kids. Yeah. The way that happened is when I was in Korea, I promised, my ultimate promise in Korea was, if I get back to the States, I would get married. You know, and I kept my promise. I got married. It didn't seem to help. I thought if I got married, I would straighten out a little. But it didn't help. Until my wife got pregnant. When she got pregnant, I thought, my God, I'm going to be a father. I'm going to have responsibility. And I quit drinking for 6 months. During that 6 months, I watered the garden 8 hours a day. I couldn't stop watering the garden. Until my wife got pregnant, or rather, when the son was born, I celebrated. And I celebrated. And celebrated. And it seemed like every time I'd sober up after that, there'd be another kid sitting at this table, you know? And one day I looked and there were 5 of them sitting there, you know? And then I thought, no wonder I drink, I got too much responsibility. I was stationed out at MCRD. I got to be a drill instructor for a while, and then I became a special instructor on weapons. And I'd head out the gate every day at 2 o'clock. People ask me that when I come on a program. They said, did you drink in the morning? I said, no, I never drank in the morning. I didn't sober up until 2 o'clock in the afternoon. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd be trembling so badly I couldn't hold a pencil. And 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'm supposed to be giving a class. 2 o'clock in the afternoon, I'd see Smith, my helper. And I'd say, hey, how about taking my class? I got something important to do. And he'd see me shaking, and he knew I was sick. And he said, shove off, I'll take it. And after a while, he just took all the afternoon classes, and I just head out the gate every day at 2 o'clock. To get to Rex's Cafe, I had to pass my house. And as I passed my house, I'd look there, and all my kids would be out there, and they'd all wave at me, you know? And I'd feel bad about it. I'd be thinking, God, I hardly know them kids. I'm going to have to start spending more time with them, starting tomorrow. And I'd go into Rex's, sick and shaking, and the next thing I knew, somebody was shaking me, pushing me out the door. And I'd leave my car there, and I'd walk home. And I'd fall in these bushes every night. It's a wonder I have eyeballs now. And I'd be saying to myself, you idiot, you did it again. It was funny, because I'd get home and my wife would be sleeping. And in the morning when I went to work, she'd be sleeping, so we just quit talking. But the guys down at Rex's Cafe told me, they said, you got nothing to worry about. There ain't no woman in her right mind going to divorce you with 5 kids. And they were right. It wasn't until I drove her out of her right mind. Yeah. And one day I walked into Rex's Cafe and a guy said, how's it going, Ski? And I said, well, my wife filed for divorce and the finance company took my car. State took my driver's license. Marine Corps is about ready to throw me out. And I got a job moonlighting as a bartender down in Ocean Beach after she threw me out. I figured if I worked in a bar, I wouldn't drink so much. Yeah. Because you got to work while you're drinking, you know. And I never remember closing the place. I used to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning, put on a uniform, catch the bus, go to the Marine base, teach school till 2 o'clock, sneak out, go to my pad, have a few drinks, put on a sports shirt, or take a nap, and at 6 o'clock I'd get up and put on a sports shirt and go 10 bar. And it got real fuzzy. I'd wake up and I'd be wondering, which 6 o'clock is it, you know? I couldn't remember which job I did last. And the big decision was, do I put on a sports shirt or a uniform, you know? I'd go out in the hallway. If there's people out there waiting for the bus, it was morning. That's all I could tell. It seemed like I'd catch that bus. I'd go to the Marine base, and I'd sneak all around the building, come in the back way to keep from passing the captain's office. Sneak into my desk, and I'd no sooner get comfortable than they'd say, the captain wants you. And I'd walk in, and it was for something stupid every morning, something I forgot to do or something I did. I remember the beginning of the end was when I walked in there, and he says, how come you didn't stand your duty this morning? I said, I got the duty Tuesday. He says, today is Tuesday. And I made a gesture. I hit my head. I said, geez, maybe I ought to go see the talking doctor or something. And we spoke a while. He said, what time do you want to go? I said, where? He says to see the docking doctor. I said, I was kidding. He said, I wasn't. So I got to see the psychiatrist. One of the first things he asked me, he says, do you drink very much? I says, not any more than anybody else. Picturing my five buddies down at Rex's Cafe. He said, well, what's your problem? I said, it's my wife. She's an unfit mother, and she's filed for a divorce and took my kids. And he wrote that down. He says, that all? I said, no. She put me in debt $2,700 in lawyer fees, squandered all my money on food and stuff. He put that down, yeah. And I gave him about a dozen of these problems to work on, you know. And I thought he was going to look at that and say, no wonder you drink. Here's 10. Go get drunk. But he didn't. He said, let's see what we can do about this. He said, we'll have the Red Cross check on your wife. If she's unfit, we're going to take the kids away. Then we'll go to the Navy Relief and borrow enough money to pay off all your bills. And he went down the line. He had a solution to every problem I gave him. And I wanted to tell him, mind your own business. I need these problems, you know. But he knew I had another problem. Because him and the other psychiatrist put their heads together. He says, you know, we believe you're an alcoholic. He says, Chaplain here has the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you give him a call? And the chaplain wrote out the number for me. And that night I was back down at Rex's Cafe just as drunk as ever. I think I called AA that night. I don't know how the conversation ended. Somebody kept saying, do you need help now? And I couldn't imagine whether they're going to hold a beer or what, you know. But I remember talking to my five buddies that night. I told them about it. I said, you know, that psychiatrist said he believed I was an alcoholic. They said, you're not an alcoholic. You don't drink any more than we do. And the handwriting was on the wall. And then I went through some rough stuff because I knew that they were going to do something about my drinking, whether I wanted it or not, and that scared the heck out of me. Anytime I thought of quitting drinking, I got scared and I needed a drink. When I'm scared, I either drank or prayed in that order, and there was a lot to drink there, so I just stayed drunk as much as possible from then on. And it got to the point where I tried to get my wife back, and I screwed it all up. I tried to shoot myself, and I screwed that up. I couldn't even shoot myself. I tried to get in a psycho ward, and they didn't let me in, you know? I thought, I'm a complete failure, a total loss. What's left? Alcoholics Anonymous. That's when I decided to call. And I remember I was afraid somebody would hear me in a barracks, so I caught a bus, and I went down to the Grant Hotel. I picked the center telephone booth, looked both ways to make sure nobody saw me. I snuck in. I didn't even know anybody in San Diego, you know. And when I dialed it, I looked like I was about to sell military secrets or something, you know. And old Howard was the secretary then. He said, come on up. He said, you're a block away. I said, okay. And I went to the California Theater building, went up to the fifth floor, walked down that hallway. And there was a chicken-wired window door with gold block letters, said Alcoholics Anonymous, and I thought it should say District Attorney, you know. And I went in there surrendering. I went in there, I wanted to enlist for 10 years, right now, before I changed my mind, you know. And old Howard stuffed my pockets with literature, and he says, there's a meeting on 12th, a 1 o'clock in the afternoon meeting at the recovery house up there. He says, you can make it. And I was back out in the hallway before I knew what happened with all this literature, you know. And I hit the street, and I was thinking, why did he let me go? Why didn't he hang on to me when he had me? I thought they were going to shackle me or something, at least, you know. And I hit the street, and there are bars all around me. I thought, I'll hit one of these gin mills, settle my nerves, and join AA tomorrow. And something kept me going. I made it all the way to the Pathfinder on 12th. And I walked in. I remember I ran across the street to make sure nobody saw me go there. There's a rickety old building. Looked like it was a condemned building about ready to fall down, a recovery house. And I ran in, and as I come in, the meeting was already underway. My sponsor was speaking, the guy that became my sponsor. And the first words I heard in an AA meeting, he was saying, the difference between a wino and a scotcho is a buck, a dollar. The first thing I heard. And I remember I sat down, I looked around the room, and everybody there was 60 years old. And I was 36, and I was thinking, well, this is it. It's all she wrote. It's all over. From now on, I come here with these old guys and whittle away my time and wait to be called up yonder. It's all over. And I was ready to accept that. I was pretty sick. And the meeting was over, and my sponsor come over, introduced himself. He says, you want to ride back to the barracks? And I thought, he works for AA, and he don't want me to stop anyplace, so he's going to drive me back, you know. He said, get in my car, and I saw you had a new Chevy. I thought, well, at least they got nice company cars. You know? And he said, get in the back seat. He said, I got another guy. And I remember when I got in the back seat, I opened that door, and I looked to see if it had handles on the inside, you know. And he drove me back to the barracks, dropped me off. And he says, you want to go to a meeting tonight? I said, no, I'm going to be busy. He says, if you change your mind, come to First and University, the Mission Hill Group, and I'll meet you there. I said, okay, but I'm going to be busy. And that night, there was nothing to do. I used to spend 10 hours a day in a bar. And I thought, if I go to the staff club, I know I'm going to get drunk. I don't want to get drunk. So I caught the bus, and I went to First and University, and I went to the meeting. And I remember I walked in, one of the first guys to shake my hand was Jim Burwell, the agnostic, the guy that gave us God as we understood him in parentheses. And Rosa was there. Rosa was our sheriff in San Diego. Rosa was about 5'2", with a pointed nose and a Philadelphia accent. And when she talked, she'd make a gunnery sergeant stand at attention, you know? And if you look like you're going to break a tradition, you get a call from Rosa at 8 o'clock in the morning. We can sure use another Rosa, you know, in San Diego. A lot of real good AAs were all in this one room. And I remember I saw my sponsor there. I felt safe. Only known him an hour. I felt like he's my father or something, you know. And I looked around the room, and there were three good-looking young gals in the meeting. I was thinking, lo and behold, we ain't dead yet. You know? And the meeting was over. My sponsor drove me back to the barracks, and he gave me a big book to read. And he said, read this. And I read that book all night. You know, I couldn't sleep anyway. A lot of people come on a program with the shakes. I had the leaps. And I read that big book all night till the alarm went off in the morning, you know. And the alarm went off. I put on my uniform, and I went to work. My captain noticed that I was sober one day in a row. And he wanted to know why. And I told him I joined Alcoholics Anonymous. He says, they're meeting at 1 o'clock today. I said, yeah. He says, take off at noon. He gave me every afternoon off for 90 days so I can make that 1 o'clock meeting. He didn't know I took it off anyway, but he I made 180 meetings the first 90 days, yeah? Two a day. I got real salty real quick. I went to East San Diego meeting. They said, Ski, would you like to say a few words? I said, I started off with, now for the benefit of the newcomer. I've been at 38 meetings already. In the first 3 years, I probably had an average of at least one meeting a day for the first 3 years. And I retired from the Marine Corps because of the grace of God in the AA program. I made it. They gave me I was the guard chief in Fallbrook, and they gave me a parade and a 7-Up Pepsi-Cola party. And I went to work for the post office. And I was driving special delivery. I had a nice soft job, and I had a beautiful station wagon to drive and living it up. The only trouble is that I worked from 3 o'clock in the afternoon till midnight. And you can't make meetings in the evening. I could have got up early and made the afternoon meeting, but it kept getting harder. And I run that job, worked nights for a year and a half. And it's bad. I was missing a lot of meetings, but it got harder and harder to make meetings. And I know that I was going off track. You know, you don't, when you sober up on a program, you do a 180-degree turn. And what happened to me during that year and a half is maybe I went a third of a degree a day off course. And there's nobody there to correct the papers. Nobody to straighten me out. So I kept deviating little by little off course. And pretty soon, you know, like if you go a degree a day off, you know, it only takes 180 days and you're going backwards. And it's hardly noticeable because it's so slight. And that's what happened to me. And one day I was driving a mail truck. I was driving a Station wagon, rather. And I was talking to myself. You know, and I was saying to myself, nothing's happening to me. Nothing good, nothing bad. I was in self-pity. I was mad at all my friends that didn't call me at midnight when I got off work. I had resentments. I had self-pity, and I had all the ingredients that you need to get drunk. And I said to myself, finally, if nothing happens to me by Saturday, I'll make something happen. I'll get drunk. And I got off at midnight. It was 11:30 at night I got off, and I drove to my apartment. With tears in my eyes, I took the token off my keychain and put it on a shelf, you know. And I drove down Broadway to the Top Hat Bar. I said, why wait till Saturday, you know? I went in the Top Hat Bar and I trembled so badly. I had 4.5 years sobriety. And it's kind of hard to get drunk after that. And I went in there, I trembled so badly that I was ashamed of myself. I went back out in the street. And I'm back out in the street. I didn't take a drink yet. And I'm saying to myself, are you an idiot? Are you a man or a mouse? Why are you trembling? You know, why are you scared? And I was ashamed to go back in there, so I went down to the next bar. And I went in there, and now I'm saying the serenity prayer to give me the courage to drink. Yeah? And it worked. I ordered a drink. I thought the bartender was going to hit me, you know? And he poured the drink, and I drank it. Immediately, I was thinking, my car's on Broadway. What am I going to do? I'm going to get another 502. I better move the car where it's safe. So I drove the car up to the Turf Club. And I parked. I lived near there. I could walk home from there. I parked the car, and I went in there, and I told the bartender, I'm social drinking, so quit walking up and down. Just keep filling my glass up, you know? And when they were about to close, I bought a bottle of vodka off of them. AA taught me how to, that vodka don't stink, you know, so I bought a bottle of vodka, and I picked up a girl, and I took her home with me into my pan. And I did, all I know is I wanted her to listen to my tale of woe or something, you know, and tearing in my beer and all that. And the cops came. I almost made jail, you know. We were playing the music too loud or something. But in the morning, I woke up, curled up in a ball, in my old position. I used to sleep on 1 square foot of bed when I drank. Curled in a ball, afraid to open my eyes, laying there cringing, saying, God, what'd I do last night? God, what'd I do last night? And I looked on the refrigerator, and there were about 3 fingers of vodka in a bottle yet. And I thought, if I drink that, I got to go get some more. And I stared at it for what seemed like a long time. And I picked up the phone, and I called up Nina in South Bay. She passed away a few years ago. I called her because she was smaller than I was. She couldn't hit me, you know. And I told her what happened. And we talked 10 minutes, and I poured the booze down the toilet. Had some tomato soup to settle my stomach, and I ate some licorice candy. That's about all. And I laid on the couch that day all night, all day and all night. I didn't go to work. And I seen my inventory go by in color. And the next day I went to work, and I told them I either got to go on days or quit. And they took away my station wagon, and they gave me a mail bag. And I was a foot soldier again, you know, delivering mail. And it was a funny thing. It was they gave me a route down in, off of Elm Street down there, First and Elm and Fort and Elm. And I had that route for about a month. And all of a sudden, Central Office moved from downtown, and they moved right on my route. He moved the mountain to me, you know. So I had a meeting for lunch every day in Central Meeting, and I needed that. And I started doing a lot of things that I didn't do before, you know. I started going to institution meetings. I was going to the psycho ward and the jail. I had Puerto La Cruz for a couple of years, and I couldn't identify with people in prisons, you know. I could identify a lot better with the people in city jail, but best of all, I can identify with them people in a psycho ward. You know? I didn't have any trouble with that part that says, restore us to sanity, you know? Well, in about 10 days, I'll have 26 years of sobriety, you know? Yeah. February 5th. And it's something that Alcoholics Anonymous gave me. I go to Czechoslovakia every year now. I've made 10 trips. I'm making my 11th trip this time. That's since I've been on program. I was there once before that, when I was a kid. And I write to the loner in Czechoslovakia. He's the only one. There's two loners in the book. But I write to this one. I send him a box of tapes. I send him a lot of tapes. I send him a four-year token. The guy's been sober in... He'll have 4 years in March. And I told him the token is not his until he earns it. So he's got to put it on a shelf. And in March, if he's still sober, he can have the token. And there were no meetings in Czechoslovakia. No Alcoholics Anonymous meetings. So I'd go the whole month there without a meeting. So I'd write 250 postcards. Margie always got one. To people on the program. I wrote to people on the program because while I'm writing to them, I'm thinking about them. And that's my little meeting that I'm having with whoever I'm writing to. And that helps. Not only that, but I have a few thousand cousins in Czechoslovakia, and half of them are alcoholic and don't know it. And when one of them came up and said to me, "How come you don't drink?" I gave him 30 minutes. This is 9:20. Says, if I stop, people will ask me questions, so I got to cut out half of my pitch. I got to this point quicker than normal. I skipped a lot. And it's about that time now, huh? I'm not an authority, but I'll answer with what I believe to be what I believe. Hi, Patty. That's something. I better put that in my talk sometimes, because somebody always asks me that after I get finished. I never got my wife back, you know. But my five kids all come to visit me. And I had a daughter who was coming to meetings for a while, for about 90 days, and she disappeared. And I'm praying for her, that's all. And I have a son that works for Delta Airlines. He doesn't drink, smoke, or anything. I don't know how he had that happen, you know. And the other three all have possibilities of being in here one of these days, you know. And they all live in different states. Sometimes that's good. When I make a tour, I have a place to stay all over the place. I have one in Salt Lake and one in New Mexico. Any other?
Repeat the question after they ask you the question. Repeat it.
Oh, okay. I remember that in the Marine Corps. We used to do that, huh? Because they can't hear the question, huh? Okay. Hi, Jackie. Did I attend any AA meetings in Czech? What? Did I start any? The question was, did I start any AA meetings in Czechoslovakia? Not yet. Because the way it was under the communists, if you wanted to assemble a group, you would have to get a permit, and you'd have to tell them who's going to be there and what they're going to say. And perhaps you might get a speaker meeting going or something where you submit a tape, and then they're going to have a commissar sit in there and make sure you don't deviate from the tape. So it was almost impossible, you know, to have a meeting. Like in Russia, they started it with the blessing of Gorbachev, where Czechoslovakia didn't go that route. They were still stern. Well, now they did the flip, and they're a democracy now. I get postcards now from my cousin, and in big letters, he puts out, "Hooray, hooray, hooray, we're a democracy," you know? Where I remember when I was, the last time I seen him, when we talk about something, He would look at the window. He'd hold what he had to say until he pulled the shades down, shut the shutters, and then he'd come back and tell me what he wanted to say. You know? So it was kind of difficult, but now it might be better, and there might be a meeting for me when I get there. I'm going to be there in May, the end of May, I'm going again. And I'll sure try to start something this time. I always said that if I ever got thrown in jail over there, at least then you can start one in jail, and there ain't much they could do about it, right? Anybody else? Any more questions?
I think it's neat about how you were worried about your
20-year
retirement and then
getting
your retirement and then how you followed up after finding
AA
and getting up to 40 years.
Explain
that a little bit.
I didn't quite understand it.
The question is about how did I handle it with retirement. I retired from the Marine Corps 20 years, I wouldn't have made it if it wasn't through this program, but not only that, but I retired again from the Postal Service on 40 years combined service. I had a little better rate in the Postal Service, so this program works. Yeah? God is doing for me what I couldn't do for myself. And that's a fact. When I delivered mail, here's a question. I'm sorry. Hi, Mike. The question is, am I active in AA today? Well, I go to at least 6 meetings a week, you know? And I'm still doing a lot of things, you know? I stay busy. I don't have much time for myself. I don't have time to have self-pity. And I quit feeling sorry for myself a long time ago. You know, if you want to really hurt tonight, go home and think about yourself all night. Yeah. Hi, Jeannie. What? Give or take. I brought a girl back from Czechoslovakia in 81 who was 33 years younger than I. And she was my fifth wife. There were a couple on the program that didn't work out. You know, that's something that I thought of. The question was, did I remarry or not? Again, you know. You know, the first time I did it with a member of AA, we got married, and she was the secretary of group and doing everything, and the last thing she heard me say was, I do. She didn't listen to me anymore after that. And we fought and fought and fought, you know, and I figured that out. Is when I married her, I thought, she's got a problem, I got a problem. We put it together and we worked that one problem together, you know. That ain't how it works. She had one problem. I had one problem. When she married me, she had two problems. I married her, I got two problems. And 2 times 2 is 4, huh? So then you have 4 problems. Which takes a lot of work. It'll work if you work it, but it's still difficult. You know, when I was delivering mail, I delivered mail in a Cadillac. Typical alcoholic, you know. I delivered mail to his doctor's office, and he drove in a Chevy, and I gave him his mail through the window. You know? He looked at my car, and he says, mailman with a Cadillac? He said, I should have been a mailman. I said, I used to drive a Chevy when I was a doctor.